Good evening, everyone. Happy quarantine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this edition of Get the Fork Out. We have Dennis Ecostola here, one of the premier provisioners in the yachting industry. And chefs already know this, but if for people that aren't chefs, your provisioner, when you're during a busy season, whether it's charter or private, is like your right-hand man or woman to help get this request sorted because the guests ask for crazy shit a lot of times. So Dennis is in Belgium. I'm in California. Dennis and I met years ago. Have been friends for a long time. I think I met you, Dennis, when you were just becoming a provisioner for the first time. But you'd already had a career as a yacht chef before that on some of the best boats in the industry. So, hello, Dennis. Welcome to Get the Fork Out.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's my first podcast, so I'm
absolutely
nervous about it. So yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been quite an honor, and I'm a big fan of your podcast myself.
Thanks,
so
man.
Let's talk a little bit about provisioning and products in general.
Yeah.
And maybe we can start with a quick look around the whole facility here where we
I'd love that.
Out. And
let's do that. And I'm right, you are in Belgium now, right?
Yes, I'm in Antwerp.
Nice.
Have you been to Antwerp before?
I rode through there in the rain one day on a motorcycle. That's all I know of it.
It rains all the time in Belgium.
I noticed the shingles also come around the eaves of the house in Antwerp in Belgium.
Yeah, it depends on where you are. There's quite a diverse population, I would say. Mainly Jewish. It's the diamond capital of the world. So if you're up for diamonds or diamond rings, then definitely come here.
Is that to buyers?
Yeah, for buyers, yeah. It's really, honestly, it's full of Jewish diamond dealers here. And quite an experience. So let's have a look at this this building. It's called Felix Packhaus. It was a storage facility, like a warehouse.
Dennis, all I'm seeing is your mouth right now. Yeah, hold it. Hold the camera farther away. Yeah. Much better. Yeah.
Right. So this building is called Felix Packhaus. It used to be a storage facility for the whole town. So all the provisions came in from the other side, where there's a big port, and they stored it in this building. So it's our little shop here.
Port's on the other side.
The port is on the other side. Yeah, we are in the port area. So it's our little tasting room here, where we invite our chefs to see the ingredients, feel them in person, and of course taste them as well. So our tastings are around 2 to 3 hours, where you get the chance to taste the world's best ingredients, of course. We always have some new stuff coming in. Also sake, I'm a massive fan of sake myself. Japanese ingredients, Korean ingredients, and equipment, you know, all the cool stuff what you need as
very
a chef.
Nice. And do you pack orders out of here, or do you have a separate spot to pack orders?
We have a big warehouse in Holland.
Okay.
This is for the large orders, but all the small orders, it makes more sense to pack them here. As it's more reactive, it's quicker. We can ship most of the times till 5 p.m. and DHL is just around the corner, so it makes it kind of a good logistic hub too.
That totally makes sense. And you're not far from Holland either. I mean, you're what, a couple hours away from the warehouse?
40 minutes. 40 minutes from the border. Not too far away from Necco, and we supply yachts. So
but we are good friends. People too. Yeah.
Yeah, we're all friends. Yeah, we are. So, yeah.
Thanks for the tour. That's cool, man. It's I've missed all of your tastings just by circumstance. Like, I'm never in the right spot at the right time, but it's one of those things I've always wanted to do, and I've heard nothing but good things, like really rave reviews. So any of you chefs out there, if you get the email, definitely go see Dennis and do one of his tastings. It's amazing. I guess that leads it. If you see me checking my phone, it's just, that's where the questions are, but this is a perfect, right, like segue into, I would love to talk about your history as a chef and your history as a yacht chef, but let's talk about your connection to, we'll get to that, but what's your connection to Japan? Like, why, how did you know so much? I mean, you're such a kind of pioneer in the industry of Japanese ingredients and techniques. And why don't you just tell us first time you went to Japan and how it's affected your life as a chef and your business.
Well, the first time I went to Japan was probably 15 years ago. And my girlfriend back then, she spoke fluent Japanese. So it's been quite an easy into the whole foodie scene. And we've been just walking into Michelin star places with the right lingo. So it was easy compared to now. Nowadays, everybody speaks English, but you're not allowed to, sit down anywhere without a reservation or without knowing anyone. Super crowded nowadays, and it's difficult to find the right ingredients. So you have to travel a lot further than just hanging out in Tokyo.
Mm.
So that's how things started. And we just started picking some ingredients off the shelf of these, high-end ingredient places in Tokyo, and we imported them. And I can still remember our first big meeting we had with the chef was in San Martin. We illegally imported like 6 bottles of each, very small product portfolio, and they all tried it, and they've been bidding each other out just to get a bottle of this, sambaisu or irizake. That was much of a goal back then.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What was it hard to initially import for the first time? Because whoever's not in Yanni realized that these things need to be imported into different countries from Japan, whether it's St. Martin or Belgium, France, Italy.
Well, as I was saying before, it was all illegal. Just, into the suitcase or via DHL. Yeah. And nowadays you cannot do this anymore. Everything is checked. You need to have the right documentation to make sure the product is not contaminated or some of the ingredients are not allowed in that country of destination. So it's quite serious compared to back then. And I would say we're quite specialized in importing in general, starting from dry stores and finishing with Densuke watermelon, where you pay around 4,500 euro per watermelon.
Oh, that's not the square one, is it? Or it's just a good watermelon?
Actually, a black watermelon, and it grows only in Hokkaido. It takes around 6 months for the watermelon to grow, and not every watermelon has the right amount of bricks. So it needs to be sweet enough.
Sugar.
In order to be classified as Densuke watermelon. And what's so special about it is it's not only sweet, it's also very juicy and crisp. So for me, it's the best fruit in the world.
Really? That's amazing, man. I remember, I think it was a few years ago, we were chatting and, I asked you what it was like to transition from being a full-time yacht chef and cooking all the time to being a provisioner. And I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, but basically you were like, my product knowledge has gone up 10,000% about what I know about food and where it comes from. So it's still kind of hitting that same love of food that you had as a chef, but as a provisioner, you're just blown away. You didn't see that coming, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was a massive learning curve in terms of product knowledge and logistics, coming from the chef's perspective. And in our tasting room, I see every single tasting
It doesn't matter if they have one, two, or three Michelin stars. There's so much that you have to learn as a chef because you cannot know everything. And there's so much new stuff coming out that you need to keep up with it all the time.
Yeah.
So it's quite advantageous to have someone who can help you to find these products and keep you up to date.
Yeah, I agree. The stuff I've used you a few times over the years, and the stuff from Japan, this Korean stuff, even the Mexican stuff, you're getting legitimate stuff from these countries, not the cheaper, dumber version from America or from France. You know, you're not getting old El Paso from Mexican. You're not getting Hikkoman soy. And so I've learned a lot through you about these boxes that you send with these ingredients. I'm just blown away. And half the shit, I can't even read the label because it's not even in my alphabet. You know, I appreciate that though. It's adventurous when you're kind of cranking in charter after charter and you get this box of goodies and this provision. You're like, oh shit, all right. And we all hang out with some spoons and we taste everything. It's so fun, man. Yeah, and I appreciate what you bring to the provisioning game for sure.
Thank you. I have to say it's quite fulfillment because cooking on a yacht, it's really such a difficult job because you have to wow your customers every single day.
Yeah.
And compared to restaurants, you can't be cooking the same dish twice. So you always need to have some extra jokers up your sleeve and, you know, be able to also tell the story as this reflects on the tip. So, again, this is one of the reasons we started to find more and more specialty ingredients in order to give the chefs more, you know, more firepower, really, when it comes to charter.
It makes a lot of difference. I just recently did a big Asian shop in West Palm, and it was like, I think because of you, but like my standards have changed, like what I want to buy for my Japanese and Korean ingredients and Chinese even. So I'm in the shop. I'm just like, oh, this is just cheap and dirty. It'll work. Like it'll work. It's just not as good as the stuff that Dennis would have got me. I'm just like, oh, Dennis, if you looked down his nose at this and this, he'd be pissed off at this. Yeah, whatever. It's got to happen. I need it. You know, like bottom of the barrel soy sauce. Like just that's all they had. Really kind of the sweet chili was okay. It was from Thailand at least. Whatever.
Right.
When did you start cooking? Like how old did that happen to you? That event?
Well, I started cooking when I was 15. I'm 40 years young now. So back then cooking was very old school, very, very boring, I would say, compared to now. And I studied in Germany. And from Germany, I had the chance to, you know, work abroad on the yacht for a German family again. So I've done this before I finished my training in Germany, working Michelin-starred restaurants over there. But back then, I also realized that this Michelin-star game, it's, you know, if you want to push yourself, it's great. But it's not that real kind of cooking where you're on the spot and you have to create something out of ingredients you don't know. Or for customers, they're very specific and demanding about what they want and how they want it. So you kind of create your own style of cooking, which is not this copy and paste. And there's a lot of copy and paste around, especially on Instagram, where you can get, you know, more than just the inspiration on how to create a dish. But what you really want to do is you want to find your own style. You want to know that you are able to create a dish which makes you happy as a chef. And it's not showing your ego and showing your attitude. I don't know. It's you see it most of the times that people trying too hard, and food should never be about this. And that some of the best food in the world is very simple. It's simple.
That's
simple
exactly it.
Simple ingredients.
Some of the chefs that even in the yachting industry that post on Instagram, some of the stuff is so complicated. Like, but I did the same as a younger chef, and I'm sure you did too, where it was almost this ego and this insecurity of I need to show everything that I know in this one dish, pretty much. Like I know all these flavors combined, And now it's trimmed down. So I want three strong flavors that accentuate and they're positive. They can even be a little bit shocking, but they're not going to be this compounded layering of like, oh God, I don't know what that's going to taste like when I see it. But I think it's, we've all done it getting into the game, I think.
I'm telling you what it is that people or chefs, young chefs, they don't start a career because of, you know, the love for food. It's so much about, I wouldn't say compensating for something, but we're all trying to do as good as we can. We want to be well-respected. We want to, you know, really show that we can do something. And as a chef, you're an artist, and everything what you create is so instantaneously, and people tell you straight away if they like it or not. It's not subjective like art, I would say. But on the other hand, you gotta, you know, find your own love with the food. If you eat Italian food and the granny is cooking for you, she cooks with her heart. There's so much energy in the food, and that makes all the difference. That's why I believe if you work on a yacht and you're trying too much, you end up with a lot of stress, which reflects itself in the food. Because the stress you're creating for yourself during the service, the customers don't even know about that. And they should get good energy from you delivered via your cooking into them. It's an exchange of energy if you really think about it.
Yeah, agreed. Like literally and figuratively.
Exactly. Plus, if you have so much money, you can go to the best restaurants in the world. Why would you actually demand free Michelin star cuisine on a yacht? It doesn't make any sense. You want to relax. You are already there. So you want to be somewhere where people leave you exactly the way how you are as a person, plus give you the food you want. So it's a lot of that. And understanding this as a chef, there's a couple of old school chefs like yourself out there. They know that this is the key to a successful charter or to happy clients, to give them what they want, adjust how they are. And then you are going to be the best chef ever in their eyes because you actually get them. So that's the whole point of cooking.
Something that there's a few comments I want to make to what you said. Like, I think yacht chefs compared to a Michelin star and not providing that or providing that, depending on your perspective. Like, what we have to do is we have to be like, imagine going to a resort for 14 days and eating at the same exact restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That is what we're up against. But what Peter Vogel brought up this really good point a few weeks ago is that, but we have way more information about our guests. We're writing stuff down. We're remembering stuff like than a Michelin star restaurant. So that is an advantage. And we have them for so long, we get to know them. But when people ask me, what's your specialty? I'm like, well, what do you feel like eating right now? And they say lobsters or they say hot dog. I'm like, all right, and that's my specialty. I will take that idea and I'll go freak it out and make it the best. And I'm reading the room too. How old is the person ordering it? What do they want? And I'm trying to figure out and read the crowd. And I think that's the most important thing, as is one of the most important things for me as a chef, is to read the room and just try to figure out what they want, how they want it. And, just give them the best possible experience, but it isn't usually 14 courses. That's just usually not the thing.
No, certainly not. I completely agree. And it's been like this for such a long time. I used to work for a very old person in the yachting industry. And the food he wanted, like, he's well known. I don't want to mention his name.
Oh, you don't have to.
What he wanted was this really old school French food, like foie gras, seared, pan-seared with lentils. And he got this French chef, and I thought he was very arrogant. He was very, you know, up himself. But the way how he cooked it was exactly that what he wanted. Nothing else. Yeah. No garnish, no fucking around. So for him, he was the number one. And that's what it is. You gotta understand this, that there's no good, there's no bad. There's just like whatever the person wants, you have to give to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to be that right chef that's willing to give it to them. Because, like, certain chefs wouldn't fit into that category. It's like, well, no garnish, or, you know, we're never going to do Thai. We're just going to do French. So you have to, someone else, Helen brought this up. It's like, you could be kind of like leave a job miserable and on one boat and then go to another one. And you're the best chef they've ever had just because you fit in there better. It's insane. Right. It's such personal taste.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
But that's the luxury part of it though, is like having a private chef. Like even going to a Michelin star restaurant, they're not really going to cook you what you want. You're there to eat what they want to give you. Whereas a private chef, we have to be these amalgamous changing,
yeah, sure.
Which is something that's the part I love. Like I don't want to cook the same shit every day. Definitely not. And that's what I love, that it's always creative. Like I can always just kind of cook what I want. I love it.
Yeah, for sure. And
how long did you work on yachts for as a chef? And how did that end? When did you realize like, nah, this is it?
So
I saved this money and.
Well, to be honest, I didn't save any money. I was just living my life, especially the first 5 years, been incredible. Being able to travel, go to all the restaurants, have that experience, which is like completely out of this world, eating like a millionaire.
Yeah.
And after 5 years, I was trying to get on bigger boats, 80, 90, 120 meters. And then you start to understand that the whole flow of the boat, the whole dynamic changes. It's so commercial that you are a piece of the puzzle, which then can be exchanged easily without the whole clockwork being different, which is something good, but also something bad, because boats need to have this special flair. All the people that work on the boat, they make the boat. It's about the people. And on such a big boat, it's very difficult to get that human kind of energy across at this level. So, I soon realized that's not that what I wanted to do. So I was looking into provisioning because I was upset with...
You? Upset with provisions? I can't imagine. What is this shit?
Okay. Now we're talking about that.
Yeah.
If you look at Metro, all these big supermarkets, suppliers, there are people, they're deciding on what you are going to have access to and what not. And that's all specific to every single country. Yep. Metro Group is right after Carrefour. They're massive. And they decide what you're going to have. So at the end of the day, there's no choice. And smaller producers, they have no opportunity to get their products onto the shelves. So that's just fueling that whole commercialization of food quality and products. And it's also, whatever sells in a Metro sells maybe somewhere else better, or it doesn't sell. So, these big suppliers are really bad. They're really bad for hospitality. They're good in terms of having the quantities for simple things like butter, flour, milk, you name it. But when it comes to actually helping chefs, they're no good. They're no good.
They're not for chefs. They're not for us. They're for home. They're for people. They're not for chefs. That's the difference. But that's all we're stuck with,
Yeah, but most of the yachts go to Carrefour
Well, you have to. There's no other option, really. For certain circumstances. Otherwise, we can use Dennis.
Now, like to be honest, I don't want to do everything anymore. That's over for our business because you cannot do it. It's the same topic. If you try to do everything, you need to find a medium line in between where you have medium quality, medium price. So you can serve everyone. But if you're specialists, then you can pick and choose from your specialists what's good for you, and you can create your own portfolio depending on how your trip goes. So it's just about, you know, command and conquer, breaking down on what is important and what is urgent for your trip. And then from there, you can choose your suppliers and you can make your arrangements, because it's getting more and more difficult nowadays with provisions, COVID, massive problem, border regulations, certifications. So how can you make sure that you always get the product you need wherever you are? You need to have a very good plan as a chef to organize yourself on what do I need? What can I get somewhere else without having to, you know, get a chip from Belgium or Holland or France? Like, it's a lot of responsibility in terms of planning for a chef, not only from making sure there's food on board, making sure that the food which is on board has been procured in a, you know, in an economic way without spending too much money and without making it difficult for the itinerary of the boat. And that's really something which has changed over the last 15 years. I remember when I first started, there was National Marine, and there were the guys, they would get you anything. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. You just tell them and they get it. And these times are over. There's so many management companies. They're checking prices, checking products. You can find everything online. Quotes. Exactly.
And I got. I had a provisioner. I had a provisioner tell me a good one, who I'm sure you know. And Catherine asked me for a quote, and I already pushed back on that. Like, it's not engineering parts, it's not tech parts. This stuff fluctuates. It is. So I got to get three quotes and then choose one provisioner and piss off the other two, waste their time. It's really inefficient, especially when you're cranking. Especially when I know you're busy, I'm busy. Like, no quote. I'm just gonna use Dennis. Like, I check the prices at the end. If it's bad, I tell them to fuck one of those things off. Like, that's too high. Like, that doesn't work. Rather than, and I'm sure you would rather do that too, than quotes for boat after boat after boat after boat.
Yeah. Quotes don't really work. You can't compare a tomato with a tomato. And everybody knows it. Unfortunately, the management company don't know that. Plus, the captain is maybe not such a specialist when it comes to food and vegetables. So it's all understandable. I'm not saying it's, you know, outrageous that they're questioning quotes, but it's not applicable for what we do when we are searching for quality and we are having to deal with non-experts who are approving these things.
Yeah, they're out of their depth. They really are out of their depth when it comes to it. You're like, but the good ones, I've had some really great captains too, where they'll never ask for quotes. And back to what you're talking about in terms of coordination, it is intense. If you're doing back-to-back charters, where are we getting our next drop? We're moving. Guests are changing their minds all the time. And then which provisioner are we going to choose as we cruise across the Med and get from country to country? How can you get trucks? Bye, Mary. You can get trucks that come over Italy, you can get into Croatia, and then what do you do if you're in Montenegro and like all this shit? It's such a logistical nightmare, but it gets easier the more experience you have. It gets a lot easier. And the captain and first officer, like that's and purser. What's going on? Where are we going? Because we need to organize this. All right, yeah, cool, sweet, done. But it's intense, but that's part of what I like too, though. I like that kind of what's going on, where are we going, like how can I get cool stuff here? Yeah. So I think you're right. That's changed.
Yeah, that changed massively. I think the future of your provisioning.
Oh, here we go.
That's my personal opinion. I think chefs should really work with several provisioners. Mm-hmm. You know, you need one main provisioner who is the guy who is taking care of the logistics and who always knows what's happening with the boat. This guy you have, that's your number one. Yeah. Then you should have your number two, which is taking care of the specialty items, because, you know, I'm not saying this because we take care of specialty items, but if you are a provisioner who is the number one, you take care of pretty much 80% already And then if you get specialty items, you need to allocate extra time for sourcing these specialty items. If you don't have any network or, you know, experience, this becomes very, very hard,
yeah.
Which means to employ more people or spend more time on sourcing, which then increases the price. So at the end of the day, it all makes complete sense. Let the people do what they're best at, and then from there, just pick who you want to work with.
Yeah.
And then it's really easy because you have a backup, really. We have a backup. You can already say, okay, this is what I need from my number one, and this is what I need from my number two. And then, of course, you have your local guys. They're all very good. It doesn't matter where you go. They're all very good at what they do.
I wouldn't say all of them. I wouldn't say all of them, man. Oh. Okay, can I bring up a pet peeve that you're, I think you're going to agree with me on this one. It's like you go into, say, Sicily or Sardinia or somewhere, and I'm not bagging on captains here, but they never really care that much. But they're like, oh, but our agent has a provisioner. I'm like, nope. Fuck no. That is not, we're not using an agent provisioner. That's not a provisioner. That is, let's take some more money from the yacht and piss off the chef. That's what that is.
Yeah, I mean.
So they aren't all good out there. I can't think of one agent provisioner that I've actually enjoyed working with. Not one.
In Italy, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist, no.
It doesn't exist. But I don't really want to get into it because you know exactly some of the Italian agents
Well, they're funny because they really specialize in Italian food, and then anything outside of that is like mystery land. And
exactly
if you ask for something else, like, well, I got it, I'm like, yeah, but you got me the lowest quality shit you could possibly find. Yeah, provisioning's a funny game. I love it though. Like it's like I said, you guys are so important to the chefs. They're so integral, and I think that gets lost on management, and that gets lost on captains. How important a good provisioner is, because they're like, I feel like provisioners to captains and managers are like throwaway. Like, I just get another one. I'm like, no, there's a relationship there. There's a camaraderie, and there's just knowledge of each other about what I've ordered in the past, cool shit I might like in the future. It's awesome. It's hyper important, especially if you're just going to crank out trip after trip.
Yeah, I think so too. But unfortunately, the way how it looks at the moment, it's never going to work that old way. And if things don't work the old way, you just have to change and create something new so that the old thing becomes obsolete. That really is the point of the whole provisions game. Because
what old way are you talking about? The old way of just one provisioner and that's it? Is that the old way?
The old way of one provisioner, the old way of, you know, quotes for some of the items. Let's take toilet paper. Okay.
Toilet paper.
As an example, right? You could foresee how much toilet paper you need as a yacht on average, right?
Yeah.
So that's where you can save money with renting storage space, having toilet paper on hand in the country, somewhere store, like smart provisioning, smart purchasing, all of these things, that's possible. And it doesn't sound a lot, but it will save you a lot of money, which you have then available for last minute items, which you cannot, you know, avoid because of clients.
You've had this idea for a while. You've had this idea for a while to have some sort of depot, some sort of just storage for just different yachts to pull off of that rather than add a car for every week, which is it's a cool idea. And I like the idea. I've never been able to use it. But I think if there was a yacht that did the same run every year, then it'd be very advantageous. You can just fill up on wine, toilet paper, oil, whatever that can just sit.
At the end of the day, it doesn't need to be just for that particular yacht. It could be like a Bitcoin shared pool, you know, where you have these items. but they already purchased there on demand, because the buying power in the yachting industry, it's fantastic. You could build your own supermarket, your own Carrefour.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Then we circle back into a metro, but it's more specific to the clientele.
The supply chain and the prices, that's the thing. You have stock on demand, and such a big industry, they should have something like this. You know, management companies, they can pull their boats and do something like this. This is the future of your provisioning, where you then obviously cut out the number one.
And I think geographically, somewhere in Italy would make the most sense. Where would you put it?
I think Italy is quite accessible, considering most of the provisions are coming from this part of the world. So driving through Germany, down through the Alps, it's a lot better instead of driving through France with traffic and tolls. And logistical access as well. Italy is quite good. I would have it somewhere in, around Genoa, Milan, Genoa. Yeah.
The reason I said Italy was to, because obviously France, Italy, and Spain are the hot spots of the industry. But you still need servicing for Venice and Croatia and Turkey and Greece and down that way in the Med too. Because although there is a really good provision in Athens, Costas is legit. He's good. But yeah, anyway, that's why I said you'd have it in Genoa for this idea. I like this idea.
I would have it somewhere around there. I mean, we used to have warehousing in Malta as well, which is actually not such a bad location if you think
about it. No, not at all.
In terms of connection to the mainland by Italy.
Yeah.
But who knows where the yachting season will move to, huh? Because the south of France is still, I don't know, it's a cool place. If you have money, that's where you can spend it. If you go to,
and you don't have COVID.
Yeah. Well, COVID is everywhere nowadays, right? So France, I think it's still gonna be a nice place. Sardinia, it's a beautiful island. I mean, you can't really take away the whole milk run because it's still interesting. And wherever else you want to go to Croatia, I mean, I haven't been to Croatia for a long time. The last time I went, I had to fly in some caviar by hand luggage because it was so difficult.
I think we'll be down there this summer, so I'll let you know. But I think what happened with Montenegro? Because that was always a weird one. For tax reasons, we'd always pick up in Montenegro both guests and food and then go to Dubrovnik and then hang out in Croatia. Is that still the case?
Yeah, because that's where your charter starts.
Because it's cheaper.
Exactly. That's one of the reasons. But Montenegro has some restrictions on the import on products. If you do it a non-commercial way, right? You work with someone, especially during COVID, we decided to work with a big transport company which has all the documents, so we don't have these issues at the borders, which are
they're an issue. Some things get stopped there and you're like waiting and the guests are waiting and there's provisions stuck. You're like, oh no.
What are you going to say? Like, I'm a yacht provisioner, here's my license. Or are you going to say, I'm a big transport company, here's my ISO, here's all my documents. And, you know, it makes a massive difference.
No, it's a good move just to get through. Yeah, those borders are weird. Because it would be much easier to pick up food in Dubrovnik. Like, it's part of the EU, it's simpler, but all the contracts are signed for Montenegro. And it's cheaper. But it's always been a hassle. And then the guy that I was using there, I think it was Yacht Pantry, Shimmy, he's packed up and gone back to New Zealand. So I don't know what's going to happen there. But, nice dude.
So here. Well, it's still a funny part of the world when it comes to provisioning, you know, because just the distance, let's look at Nice. Nice is actually quite far away from any big city in France. Like, you got Marseille, but from Paris to Marseille, and then from Marseille to Nice, it's long distances for products to grow in the center of France or coming from Holland or Belgium. And then if you have to go all the way to Croatia, you know, it's a 2 day, 2.5 day trip.
Yeah.
Just with one truck. Yeah. It's not very good for your produce either. And local agriculture is, I don't know how it is now, but back then it was pretty shit, to be honest.
No, it was rough. It was, I remember we got a pork belly, like with hair still on it, just wrapped in newspaper and just chucked in the plastic. I'm just like, oh my God, it smelled like farm. You know, I'm like, all right, this is nice. I'm sure it's fresh. But yeah, it was not kind of what we were used to in the processing and, you know, fish coming in wrong. And you're like, oh, fuck. Yeah, it makes a lot more work. I think that's another thing that captains of management don't understand as a bad provisioner or the cheap way. It takes away from the guest experience, because then the chef needs to just do so much more work than they would have had to if the things just showed up properly in a way to be stored easily. And such a crapshoot. It's like, of all the money that yachts spend, it's like, oh, but make sure you crack down on the food. Like, come on. It's nothing. It's pennies.
Just the workload for chefs. At the moment, I'm cooking at home for the family. I have a brand new son, 6 months old. His name is
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm making an effort to cook for the family. But there isn't enough time in the world, right? And then if you're your chef, you're cooking for the crew, you're cooking for the guests, there's always last minute orders. It's an extremely stressful job to do every single day at this high level with, you know, impossible missions, impossible timelines when it comes to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So you need to have products they perform. You need to have suppliers they perform. And you don't want to have more problems. You know, that's the least thing you want. More fucking problems.
Right. No, I agree. And when provisions come in and you see all the happy things that you ordered, you're like, yes, yes, that's time. You know, that's time that I save by not making my own gravlax, but getting the best stuff that Petrosian offers or someone local that I can find. Like, to have it, and plus these stories as well, you can tell with certain things, like, you just can't do it all. Although I love making things from scratch, it's also nice to be like, yeah, I got this from here because of this. It's really good. You're going to love it. And it's just knowledge, passing it on.
It's actually a good topic, talking about, you know, shortcuts, but you can order as a chef to make your life easier.
Yeah.
There's a lot out there, but what's your take on it? Like pre-cooked meats, for instance, or pre-packaged meats, the way how it's been customized for you, you know, it's, I have some chefs, they are extremely anal about the way how their chicken wings, for example, how the chicken wings are trimmed. You know, like all of these things, they make their life easier. And that's the expert service you do as a provisioner. That's really what I, because in the restaurant, it almost, in the restaurant industry, it almost doesn't exist.
That it just shows up as it is.
Exactly. Yeah. He's like, you know what? Fuck you. You have 20 people in the kitchen. Do your own trimming. Right. Yeah. So this is a really important topic for juice.
I'm thinking about a couple pain in the ass things that juice.
It's in a good quality, almost like handmade.
Yeah, I'll have to try some of those. It's like it just depends on what situation you're in. And that's what's great about provisioners. Because if you're screwed, you need to start buying juice. You need to start buying stuff. If you're coming in, like, I've arrived 10 minutes before guests arrive once for an 8-week charter. Like, 8 week, you can smooth it out over the time if the first couple of days are a fuck up. But with no prep, you're like, oh, damn it. All right. And then we're in the Bahamas, and everyone had, sorry, we're in Antigua, and every provisioner had left Antigua anyway. So it wasn't a big deal. They were fun. They were easy. Some of the pain in the ass things I order, boned out baby chickens. No one likes doing that shit. But I like cooking with boned out baby chickens because they're so much easier than boning them out myself. So I get them half boned out. Yeah, it's a weird. It's almost like a provisioner test to see if they'll do it because their butcher won't want to do it. I'm like, they're like the legs too. I'm like, yeah, the legs. You can leave the wing, take the legs. I had this. I asked for this once in. I don't remember where it was. Somewhere in Ibiza area. I can't remember. And so I asked for boned out baby chickens. He brought whole chickens, full-grown chickens, not cut in half, boned out completely, even the wings. It fucked me up. I have an Instagram because I have a whole chicken in my hand with no bones, just going like, he's like, it took me 45 minutes, each chicken. I'm like, you could have split them in half, bro. I had no idea. So cool.
There's definitely some really good old-school butchers out there. They can do whatever, and they just do it for the challenge.
Yeah, that's what this guy was. He like giggled as he handed it to me, this sack of boneless chickens. It was like, it was bizarre. It was so weird. But yeah, that's another tick in the favor of provisioners. Like, they save you time. They're giving you time. They're giving you, and I know I'm complaining about time a lot, but honestly, some of our days are like 18-hour days or longer. Sometimes you get a break in the middle somewhere, sometimes you don't, depending on the guest, and it's just hectic. So if you can get these little tricks, these little get out of jail free cards, just like boom. And if you have the time to do it yourself ahead of time, of course, have them done and ready in the freezer and dry stores. But sometimes you need to get some stuff in that's just going to help you, like, all right, that appetizer is pretty much done. That's three things put together, finish, next, and continue on. But right. I don't want to get too far off topic because one of the things that I want to ask you about was, like, I saw during COVID you went Koji crazy. What Koji mad, man? It was all your posts. It was awesome. And it was, I think that was, you were the first, I think you were the introduction to Koji to me. And I just thought it was really cool. And just the like mold covered carrots and Koji aging beef. So how did that start, man?
Well, that started most probably 4 years ago in Nice when I first experimented with koji or shio koji, and I made it on my balcony. So it's very simple. You just need to have your koji rice, water, and salt. And the salt helps to keep the bad bacteria out, whilst the water and the koji start to lacto-ferment, which then protects the whole ferment for, bad pathogens and bacteria. So this is what I was doing on my balcony in the chart. I was like, this is funky. It's like natural wine. It's a really nice acidity. I loved it, right? So that was the first encounter of koji. And then I started to grow my own koji directly on the rice. And now we have a dedicated company for this called Kojinomics. So we make koji products, plus we refine products with koji. So we have customers, restaurant customers that want to have a whole, beef ribeye koji fight. And what it does is the koji starts growing on the surface of the meat. And the enzymes will turn the proteins into amino acids. So it will create more flavor, natural MSG. It will tenderize the meat at the same time. And it will accelerate the aging process. But not only, like half, like 10 times faster than the usual process.
Than dry aging.
It's really incredible what you can do, what kind of flavor profiles you can develop with it. And, the applications are virtually unlimited. We've done some coffee where the coffee beans are getting kojified. Wow. So then after the roasting, the coffee has this really toffee, subtle aromas, but it's almost like amplified. So you can really taste that the koji has changed the structure of the flavor molecules in such a short time.
So is it better than sending a coffee bean through a civet and out its ass in Indonesia? Does it give you more flavor than that?
Well, I reckon if you do both, that's going to be...
No, leave those poor civets alone. I've been to Indonesia. It's like scary, man. Just people just force feeding these poor weird cats. Just no. Because I mean, like, the koji, I believe, but like if you had a coffee bean and you rocket it through an animal, it's like those beans are so hard. Like, how are the enzymes even going to work on it? Like, I just refuse to believe that it changes the flavor. And yes, I think it's cruel.
Something to do with the enzymes too. So it's the same process. What the koji does to every single product. For example, if you have dairy and you combine it with koji, it will accelerate the aging process. So your milk turns into cheese, but not in terms of texture, in terms of flavor. So depending on which milk you use, you have different notes from blue cheese to Parmesan. You know, it's really freaky what enzymes can do if they're applied correctly in terms of amount, temperature, humidity during the fermentation process. So you can create all of these familiar flavors. You can make a clear blue cheese dressing. Completely clear. Why? And it tastes most probably better than any blue cheese you tried before because it's so detailed and complex.
Are those enzymes related in any way? Like koji and what kicking off blue cheese? Like, are they related at all?
Well, it's creating the cheesy flavors faster. As you would age them usually to create those flavors. The enzymes are just supercharging the liquids, the proteins, and then turning them into this cheese-like flavor. You can make butters with it. They're completely detailed. You can then use the ingredients and use them for your cooking. So let's say you make a koji butter and you bake bread and you add the butter during the baking process. The koji will start to still work and enhance the flavors. It's really magical. So we've been producing since around 1 year professionally or commercially koji plus the liquids. And all our restaurant clients use them too. So it's like every single chef tries it and they're like, dude, that's the last 20% of flavor I've been missing all my life. And that's what it is. It really adds that last 20% when you try something, you're like, it's good, but there's something missing. I can't put my finger on it. The koji will connect both parts into one. It's really the next level.
And then how would you introduce it to a yacht chef? Like how, so I saw you had those cedar boxes, and are there kits that people can buy to kind of like start this experimentation on board?
Yes, so you could grow koji on board yourself. I would only recommend this to someone who has previous experience in terms of, you know, fermentation, because it's quite a commitment time-wise and, you know, concentration-wise as well. Just do it the right way. It's like having another child. But what we do is, let me show you. So this here is the koji rice.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? Is that a certain kind of rice, or is that kojified rice?
It is. The base is a smoked arborio risotto rice. It's super. It's very special.
Wow. Really
special. So you have to inoculate the rice with the spores.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's been inoculated, they start to grow on top of the rice. But like every fungus, what it does is they start to dig into the center of the rice, then feed off the starch and grow from the inside to the outside. That's where you can see you have this.
Is it the mycelium that's doing it?
Exactly. You have this mycelium, which is just coating it almost like a spider web, right?
Yeah.
And then the rice itself, like this one is crazy. Like I can't even explain how this tastes because it's been now in the fridge for 4 or 5 days. It's one of those experimental batches we showed to the chefs. So that's the base. So with this base, you can make this. It's shio koji. So right. Shio koji is usually with the rice inside. So it's this slurry paste, almost like a miso. Mm-hmm. But I figured that nobody wants to be cooking with like rice bits and bobs in their seasoning. So this is all gravity filtered in a special process to make it clear, but it still keeps the enzymes. So this shio koji has 5% salt. So it acts like a brine as well. Let's say you take a fish fillet, you brine it for 3 hours in it, just a little bit of a marinade. The amino acids will be created by the shio koji. So the flavor becomes a lot deeper. It starts to caramelize a lot faster. It's really brilliant for scallops or squids. When you sear it, you have a super thin, micro-thin layer of caramelization going on without it being burned. And it has this really toffee-like flavor. So anyway, this is our signature, well, both of our signature flavors. One of them is the sakura flower one based on rice koji. And that's the sakura leaf one based on barley koji. So barley koji, you most probably know from Noma, that's the most favorite koji because it's quite woody, almost like tobacco. It's very deep, so it's great for meats. And the rice one is fairly neutral, I would say, but it goes into the direction of a fruity vinegar. And this is really like woodruff, marzipan. It just keeps on rolling, tobacco, leaves. So you can use them for seasoning. You can use them to put into your cream. And then the cream will turn into cheesy flavors. You can have a beurre blanc or a champagne sauce and add this to add acidity. You can brine meats to make them tenderize them. You can, you know, make your own dried seafood, which is a project I'm working on at the moment. So let's say you have fresh oysters. You brine your oysters with this one for 24 hours. Then you dehydrate them at 70 Celsius. You keep the brine. And once they're dehydrated, you start boiling the oysters in the liquids, the same principle as you would make oyster sauce in China. And then you dry it at 40 Celsius. And once it's dry, you just pulverize it. So what happens is, I'll show you, it's really, this is one of the most bizarre things.
Koji oyster powder. That sounds intense. Yeah.
Okay. So this is the oyster powder. I don't know if you can see it properly.
Yeah.
So what happens is the enzymes, they still start working on it and the flavor changes. So it tastes like there's MSG in there, but basically what the koji has done is it has created its own MSG out of the oyster.
Yeah.
So it's a completely
different flavors. You just made an umami bomb.
Yeah,
it's an umami bomb right there. I want to try that.
This one is amazing. So it's a pickled radish. It's also done the Chinese way, where you salt it at first, lactoferment, and then you almost sun dry it. And after that, you brine it with vinegar and koji. So that's been brined for 1 year. The flavor is out of this world.
I believe it.
So you can make really cool things, very simple things, with the help of koji, just to enhance the flavor.
Yeah, that's probably the most amazing radish on the planet, because let's be honest, radish is kind of neutral. You know, you use it as a vehicle for stuff and a nice texture. But that radish probably is the most, that's like a Harvard professor of radishes. It's an interesting radish to be around.
Certainly. This is the last one. You saw it on my Instagram. It was this celeriac, which was like fully had this casing of koji. So what you do is you steam the celeriac with skin on, then you peel it, then you brine it in sheep koji, then you grow the koji on it. After that, you ferment it in the fridge, and then you dry it. So the outcome is this really almost like a katsuboshi, celeriac katsuboshi, and you can just grate that on a dish, and it tastes like celeriac, toffee, a little bit like cacao. Like,
awesome.
Things are fermented. Can you imagine if you have vegans on board, vegetarians, just using something like this will change the world.
And I love this because it stores not indefinitely, but a long ass time. You can do it at the beginning of the season and have enough to get you through. And these are the things, if you have time to prep, awesome. Like, yeah, that's really, and it just sets your food apart. It's really cool, man. Yeah. I'm down to try it. Down to try it.
Definitely. I will send you some special badges as well. But one last thing I want to show you, because I'm very happy about this.
All right, let's see it.
So we started working with this company from Korea called Hanega to make vinegars since 35 generations. And this is a vinegar made from Korean red pine needles and ginkgo berries. You never, ever tried something like this before in your life. It's an LSD-like flavor experience of a product where, like, seriously, every single tasting I have, people, they're just baffled. They don't believe that flavors like this exist in a vinegar. So detailed, so well balanced. It's really the next big thing. And they're quite known in the US. All the big restaurants work with it. But in Europe, no one works with them. So now we started to import, and we are, you know, marketing it to our chefs. And it's been really, really interesting to see what they think about it, because it changes completely the way how you cook with vegetables. You don't need that's the shit. It's such a good vinegar. And
I'm
we
so
have
right now, and that sounds amazing. I would just drink it with water.
You should, if you have time, we can have a virtual tasting, as we like to call them. So we go through all of the ingredients we have, and I try to explain as good as I can about them.
Yeah.
But there's so much to see just on the items what we have in the shop, which is like fun. It's so much fun because you're getting that fire back. You kind of miss sometimes, especially before the season. You need to have something to look forward to, new items to try, and of course, you know, working on your own.
We can talk about this off camera, but I think I'll see you soon. I'm going to head up to Holland and hopefully Germany as well before I join back with Arians. It just comes down to COVID. But Side note, I was COVID positive 3 weeks ago. Now I'm COVID negative. And so I think that gets me a little bit of a carte blanche. It's not the vaccine, but it's kind of the same. Like, yeah, that's why my voice sounds like this.
How was it?
Easy. Without getting too much into it. Yeah, it was like 2 days of not feeling okay, but it wasn't that bad. So I got it very easy. I have a tendency to be like, oh, yeah. I don't want to downplay it because I know a lot of people had struggled with it. Two friends of mine on the boat, they got it. They were down for like 3 weeks. They were sick. I didn't get that, but it was there. Slept a lot, but yeah. So anyway, I will be up there for sure. I'm gonna do a little road trip with my dad, and then this, man. I'll see you. Because I'm gonna go to I think I'll be based out of Rotterdam while I'm there, and then I'll move around, man. It's not far.
45 minutes from us.
Yeah. Yeah. Sweet. One last question. Can you give us a funny story of ridiculous provisioning requests, either from a guest that you know, via the chef or just the chef fucking it up? Like tins of watermelon.
That watermelon was definitely out there, where we had this request for the Densuke watermelon, which is a black watermelon for a colored individual. So all he likes is black fruit. So we had to get this. And it was so insane because he cannot import this fruit the normal route. So we had to engage a team in Japan to get the fruit within 2 days. To get the food from Hokkaido to Tokyo, special transport. It came in a wooden crate where you transport artwork in to Tokyo, from Tokyo to Amsterdam. And from Amsterdam, we picked up the watermelon and we had to repack it because it went onto a smaller plane. And then from there, it went to the Czech Republic and then to Sardinia. So I was meeting the watermelon with the truck in Sardinia and, Italy.
You were meeting the watermelon.
I was flying in just for that. There was another person standby for this. So what happened was I went to the customs and they said, there's no watermelon. And I looked at the guy saying, what do you mean? I have to fight you. He's like, no, there's no watermelon. We are in Italy. We have the best watermelons. There's no watermelon shipment for you.
Oh, and I was like, typical Italian thing to say.
It's like, this cannot be true. So I went to grab my wallet and I was like, so where's the watermelon? And it turned out there was a watermelon, which he then handed over. And I delivered it to the boat. And the boat was very happy.
Good.
But this is insane shit. This is really the most I've ever done in terms of adrenaline, uncertainty, and what could go wrong if you charge €4,500 per watermelon?
So all said and done of this anxiety riddled story, with all your time included, how much do you think that watermelon cost?
But we sold it for $4,500 per watermelon.
Okay.
And we had six of them. it was really mission impossible. But every single person in the chain was doing their job at the right time. And we've been super lucky. Because if there would have been just one delay of the plane, then you miss the next connecting plane, then there's not another flight. Something wrong with the car. And it was temperature sensitive as well because it couldn't be too cold. So once these watermelons are harvested, they need to stay the same temperature.
So, what a nightmare. Because every person in that chain has to not mess up. Like
crazy. Like Japan was like popping the champagne bottles when their watermelons left Japan. And they knew they arrived safely in Europe. So that was really the worst. And we have another mission like this coming up. So I don't know if we can do it, but
That's crazy to go fly yourself to go meet a watermelon. It's like it's almost like delivering a special agent or something.
Yeah, well, I was classified as a tourist several times, just flying around the world with suitcases full of food and having rental cars waiting. I mean, it's dodgy if you really think about it. So these are all the little things you gotta make sure you're not getting, you know, pulled out of line one day.
Good stories, though. Yeah, good stories. Thanks for spending the time with me and talking about what you do and what we do. And much respect to you. I think you're one of the best provisioners in the game because of who you are and how meticulous you are. And it's been really cool to watch your business grow. I respect you a lot, and I'm glad we're friends.
Thank you very much, Brian. Same to you, Nathalie. I hope we're going to be working together this season.
Yeah.
And please, if you have time, come down. I would really like to show you everything. Also, the fermentation lab. It's super interesting.
I'd love to do that. I have the time to do it.
Right.
It's just been kind of weird with being sick for a little bit. It kind of puts a damper on your spirits and like what you're planning to do. But now I'm good. I'm ready. But thanks, dude. Nah, I appreciate it. I'll see you in Antwerp. Thanks for being on Get the Fork Out.
Thanks for your time. Take care, Brandon. Bye.
See you, homie. Bye.